Welcome to the ministry of the House of David Fellowship in Richmond, Virginia. The Gospel of the Jews and the Zodiac in Romans 10. And the reason that I have chosen this title is because we're going to talk about all of these items, and they're pretty significant. What I've done is I have put together some questions that we're going to answer in this presentation. And these are questions that I was just asked recently in Costa Rica. But I've also been asked these questions before, so I figured let's just go ahead and get a half a dozen questions out of the way in the first presentation. So the first one is, what did Abraham believe that allowed God to declare him in right standing? We see that in Genesis 15. It says, Abraham believed, but it doesn't say what Abraham believed in verse 6. Well, I'm going to show you what Abraham believed. How did the Jews hear the gospel before Yeshua was even born? Yeah. The Jews, all the Jews that were present in the Jerusalem area and in the diaspora, all knew the gospel before Yeshua ever came on the scene. We're going to find out how they knew it. The question that has been was asked me while I was in Costa Rica, do the Jews need to be saved to make the first resurrection? They had a certain belief down there. We're going to look at some scriptures to find out whether or not they need to be saved to make the first resurrection. This is a very generic question, but I'm going for a specific answer. What is the glory of Elohim? The scriptures define it, and I'm going to show you that. If the mind of the flesh, and this is from Romans, so you all have probably read this before, if the mind of the flesh does not and cannot submit to God's Torah, what is the implication for the mind of the Spirit? I'll repeat that question. If the mind of the flesh does not and cannot submit to God's Torah, what's the implication for the mind of the Spirit? I'm going to bring a leading Protestant Christian scholar from the 20th century, and he's going to tell you exactly what the case is. And why is this presentation being done? Because this is the in-depth look at Romans 10, verse 4, which in the KJV reads something like, is Christ the end of the law for all believers? We looked at it 2 weeks ago in a preliminary view. Today we're going to beat it to death. All right, let's begin. This is the outline of what we're covering. We're going to cover Dr. Wright's, a couple of quotes from Dr. Wright's book, The Law in Romans 2. We're going to look at Galatians 3 because Galatians 3 holds the key for the Jews, holds the key for the Jews and the gospel. We'll see that. Then I'm going to look at the problem with proof texting, and the reason that I'm going to look at that is because you have to be careful with pulling scriptures out of context. And I'm going to show you an example that some of you may be familiar with. Then we're going to look at Romans 9:30 through 10:5, and I'm going to use a form of interpretation called eisegesis, and this is where I read into the text what I want it to say. So during that time period, I'm going to ask you not to follow along in your Bibles because obviously it's not going to contain what I'm going to read into the text. So you'll have to read the text from the screen. But then after I do that and you become very appalled, then we'll redo that section using exegesis, which is the Greek word for reading out of the text what it actually says. And then we're going to finish with Psalm 19 and Genesis 15. All right, so let's get started with Dr. Wright. He makes a note, several times Paul says more or less that Christians keep the law. He mentions a couple of passages. Then he makes this comment. Then there's Romans 8, in which it is the mind of the flesh that does not and cannot submit to God's law. He quotes the verse there. And he follows that with this very intriguing sentence. The clear implication is that the mind of the Spirit can and does. Leading Protestant Christian scholar, the mind of the Spirit can submit to God's Torah and does. Interesting. The law, which is the Greek word nomos, in Paul is the Jewish law. Then this is his summary. Gentiles do not possess the law by birth. 2, the law defines Israel over against the nations, and moreover indicates that Israel is designated by the Creator God as a light to the nations. We would concur with that. 3, the law sets the standard by which Israel will be judged. He says Gentiles will be judged without reference to it. But look at point four. However, there is one class of Gentiles who, in a sense, will be judged with reference to the Torah. Who might that be? This class consists of Gentile Christians, though by birth they do not possess the Torah. They are now in the strange position of doing the law since, fasten your seatbelts, the Spirit has written the work of Torah on their hearts. This is from a leading Protestant Christian theologian of the 20th century. He recognizes from Romans 2 that the Spirit has written the work of Torah on Gentiles' hearts. Number four, Israel boasts in her possession of the law. It sets her apart from the nations. But five, the boast is not made good, because that could be so only if Israel kept the law perfectly. This is not the case. Israel is still in exile, still in her sins. She's still guilty of lawbreaking. This is Dr. Wright's conclusions about the law and Gentiles in Romans 2. Let's go back to that quote. The class consists of Gentile Christians that are now in the strange position of doing the law since the Spirit has written the work of Torah on their hearts. That is an amazing conclusion for a Protestant Christian scholar to come to concerning the Torah for Gentile Christians in this age. So I just wanted to set the stage with that. Now we're going to pick up in Galatians 3, and we're going to look at a few verses so that I can set the stage for what we're going to do. Remember, our key point here, our primary purpose is to deal with Romans 10:4. KJV, Christ is the end of the law. That's what we're dealing with. Keep that in focus as we go through this. Galatians 3:6. Even as Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for right standing. Know ye therefore that they which are of faith, that is, exercise that same faith, the same are the children of Abraham. And the Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the heathen through faith, that's us, preached the gospel to Abraham. So here's the testimony. Whatever the gospel is, God preached it to Abraham. That was a long time ago. And then he said, in thee shall all the nations be blessed. So then, they which be of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham. For as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse. Why? It's written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do. In other words, it is a great thing if you want to follow the Torah in your flesh, but you can't mess up once, because if you do, you are cursed. And that's a problem. But guess what? God foresaw the problem. But that no man is justified by trying to observe Torah in the flesh, in the sight of God, it's evident. Paul quotes Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith. Gosh, God made it so simple. It's so amazing. As I was putting this together this week, I was like overwhelmed at how easy this is. Verse 12. Doing the law in your flesh is not by faith, but the man that doeth them shall live in them. 13. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. It's written, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. So going back to verse 10, cursed everyone that does not obey the Torah perfectly. There you go. 14. Why? That the blessing of Abraham might come on the Gentiles through Yeshua the Messiah, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. God saw the whole thing from A to Z. 15. Brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it be a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannulleth or addeth thereto. What is Paul talking about here? In verse 15, he's setting up a halakhic argument of light and heavy. And the way he's going about doing it is establishing that a man's covenant between a man and a man is lower than a covenant that involves God. Whether it's between God and God or God and man, a covenant between man and man is lower. So therefore, the light and heavy argument applies. He doesn't finish it, but what he's establishing here, what he's beginning to set up is, if you just have a man's covenant, forget a covenant with God. If you got a man's covenant and it's confirmed, then nobody can change it. That's the lower. So imagine if God's involved, can any man change it? All right? So why? Verse 16. Now to Abraham and his seed was the covenant made by God. But here's an interesting note that Paul brings out. He says, and to seeds, he said not as to seeds as of many. In other words, it wasn't plural, but as of one, singular, to thy seed, which is Christ. Once again, he's quoting Genesis, which we will break down in just a moment. But as you can see here, he is bringing out that a covenant between man and man, if it's confirmed, nobody disannuls. So what about a covenant between God and man? All right, this is the key. Now let's summarize. If you're going to attain right standing by doing the law, you got to do it perfectly. You can't make one mistake. But God, knowing that was not going to happen, provided a way. The gospel is the way. And it was preached to Abraham by God. We saw that. And Abraham believed it. And because he believed it, God declared him in right standing. All right, so there is our, that is our opening position. All right, now, let's move to the problem with proof texting, because remember, we are focused on the issue of Romans 10:4. Christ is the end of the law, forever, for everybody who believes. What is proof texting? I took this directly from Wiki online. Proof texting is the practice of using quotations from a document, that includes the Bible, to establish a proposition. So far, it doesn't sound so bad. Using discrete quotations is generally seen as decontextualized. Now, my dictionary didn't think that was a word, but I like this word. Decontextualized is like taking something out of context. And we know that that's what proof texting is, and I'm going to give you an excellent example. You're going to love it. Wiki goes on to say, critics of the technique note that often a document quoted in such a manner, when read as a whole, may not in fact support the proposition for which it was cited. And this is constantly the case that we in the Hebrew Roots movement face. Now, I want to give you an excellent example. Better than excellent. What's better than excellent? I don't know, but this example is better than excellent. All right, of proof texting. It goes like this. Then Judas went away and hanged himself. Go and do likewise. Now that's a problem. So therefore, we have to be careful with proof texting. We need to be sure that when we are quoting something, we're quoting it with context. Now, eisegesis... This is the interpretation of a text, like the Bible, in which we read into it what we want it to say. And this comes in very handy when I'm trying to make a case and I know I can't. All right? I also would qualify it under proof texting and out of context-ing. All right? Because taking stuff out of context is a problem. Romans 10:4, Christ is the end of the law. I'm keeping you focused on what we are solving. All right? When this verse says that in the KJV, what are they? The editorial committee that wrote the KJV and came up with Christ is the end of the law, what were they really saying? That is the question we're going to answer. All right, here's where you need to pay attention to my slides and not look at your scriptures, because otherwise you're going to actually read the Word of God. That's not going to work. I'm starting at Romans 9:30, and we'll go to Romans 10:5. So just enjoy. What shall we say then? that the Gentiles, which followed not after God's righteous standard, have attained right standing by faith. But Israel, which tried to fulfill God's righteous standing in the flesh, hath not attained right standing. Why? Because they sought right standing not by faith, but as it were by trying to keep God's righteous standard through fleshly effort. They stumbled at that stumbling stone, Yeshua. As it's written, "Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and a rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed." Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Jews is that they might be saved. For I bear record that they have zeal, but they are not going to be saved the way they're going about it. For they, being ignorant of how God wanted it done, could not fulfill God's righteous standard in the flesh. Therefore, Christ abolished God's righteous standard forever for all believers. Now, Moses describes God's righteous standard in the Torah this way. Then he quotes Leviticus 18. And I ask you, what did that say? Does it make sense here that the translation, "Christ abolished God's righteous standard forever for all believers," does that fit because the Jews were not able to fulfill it in the flesh? Doesn't fit the context. All right, now let's rewind and do it again. What shall we say then? The Gentiles, which followed not after God's righteous standard, have attained right standing by faith. But Israel, which followed after God's righteous standard, hath not attained right standing. Why? Because they sought right standing not by faith, but as it were by trying to keep God's righteous standard through fleshly effort. They stumbled at the stumbling stone, Yeshua. As it is written, "Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and a rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed." Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Jews who are not believers is that they might acquire right standing by believing in the finished work of Yeshua. I bear record that they have a zeal to be found in right standing before God, but they're not going about it the right way. For they, being ignorant of how God imparts the status of right standing, went about setting up their own way and have not submitted themselves unto the way God designed. Therefore, believing in the finished work of Yeshua is the goal of the Torah for right standing before God for all believers, Jewish and Gentile. Now, Moses describes God's righteous standing in the Torah this way: "The man which does these things shall live by them." But the righteousness which is by faith, that's the man who obeys Torah by having his character changed supernaturally, that righteousness says the following: "Do not think that someone needs to go into the heavenlies to fetch the Messiah," that is, to bring him down from above, "or that someone should go down into Hades to bring the Messiah back up again from the dead. But what does the righteousness which is by faith say? The word is nigh, even in thy mouth and in thy heart, that is the word of faith which we preach." Now, the next two verses are very popular verses, but we need to think Hebraically and not Greek, which is mental assent, when understanding these two verses. For example, to recognize someone as Lord using a Greek mindset acknowledges their position, whereas Hebraically means you submit with your whole being to their lordship. Here we go. Verse 9. "If thou shalt confess with your mouth that Yeshua is Adonai and order your life accordingly, and shalt believe in your heart that the Most High God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. For with the heart man believes in the finished work of Yeshua, and is granted right standing. And the mouth is used to acknowledge what is in the heart. For the scripture says, whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. For there is no distinction between the Jew and the Gentile as regards how to achieve right standing. For the same Lord gives generously unto all that call upon him. I have highlighted that call upon him because that phrase is going to be repeated now in several verses and is very key. 13. Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And in this particular case, the Hebrew and the Septuagint in Greek do not align, so that's why I gave you the second reference there. Now, these last five verses that we're going to cover here are going to be expanded in bullet form so that you can see how they break out. So, just wanted to prepare you ahead of time. 14. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? In other words, you can't call on him for salvation until you have believed that God has raised him from the dead. All right? But how can they call when they haven't believed? And how can they believe in whom they have not heard of? And how shall they hear unless we send a preacher? And how shall they preach except they be sent? All right, now let's bullet it out. How shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? How shall they believe in him whom they have not heard? How shall they hear without a preacher? How can a preacher preach unless he's sent? This is Paul's argument. Let's look at it in reverse order. We need to send. We need someone or something to preach about Yeshua. Then when they've heard, they can choose to believe that he's the one. Then they can call on him. There's your reverse order. All right, now. This continues verse 15. How shall they preach except they be sent? By quoting Isaiah 52:7. How beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of good things. For they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah said, Lord, who hath believed our report? Now note this. Note the sentence there. They have not all obeyed the gospel. To state that not all have obeyed implies that some did. Otherwise, that sentence would be phrased differently. If some did and some didn't, then number one and number two of verse 14 have already been accomplished. Somebody or something was sent, and what they did was they preached Yeshua. That's what verse 16 tells us. 17, consequently, faith that Yeshua has completed his work comes from hearing the message preached. And the message that is heard is the word about Christ's completed work. He made it so simple. Now, here we go. For those people who do not have Christ's completed work, but have God's completed work, UBS is United Bible Society. This is version 3. They give a B reading for Christ instead of God. So if you're into textual criticism and you need to see the verification, I have the Greek New Testament here, and I have it bookmarked. So you can look it up if you need to see it. But I believe Christ is the correct translation there. Verse 18, Paul says, and this is the key to the argument. This is it. I say, did they fail to hear? Yes, they did. What is the evidence that the message was delivered? Paul says the following sentence. Their voice went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the world. Where does that come from? It comes from Psalm 19:4. This answers what part of the four? Going back to verse 14. Reverse order. One, we need to send. And two, Whatever sent needs to preach Yeshua. All right, let's see how it fits. We will now look at Psalm 19, 1 through 4. The heavens rehearse the glory of Elohim, and the expanse sets forth his handiwork. Day after day, constantly speaks forth prophecy, and night after night reveals knowledge. There's no speech or language where their voice is not heard. And then Paul's quote, their voice has gone out into all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So what we have here is the heavens during the day speak forth prophecy. This is an expanded Hebrew translation. I have translated these four verses from the Hebrew myself. There's no place on the planet, no matter what your language is, where you cannot understand what is taking place. And then Paul quotes verse 4 to say that it's gone out into all of the inhabited world. And this is how the Jews knew the gospel before Yeshua was ever born, is right here. Now, how does that work? Well, let's go to Genesis 15 and see how it worked for Abraham, because if you remember, Galatians said, God preached the gospel to Abraham. Verse 18, the scripture foreseeing that God would justify the heathen through faith preached before the gospel unto Abraham, saying, in thee shall all nations be blessed. 3:16, I'm just reminding you of what we've already read. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. Now he didn't say to seeds as many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Yeshua. Now let's look at verse 5 of Genesis 15. Look toward the heavens and tell the story of the stars in their order. And God said unto him, so shall your seed be. This is what Paul quoted in Galatians 3. Seed is not plural. I used to read this verse and thought that it was talking about, look at all the stars in the heavens, and that's how the multitude of your inheritance is going to be. But Paul corrects that by saying that seeds is not plural. Seed is singular. And he says that it's referring to Yeshua. So what is happening here is that Abraham exits his tent and is told to look toward the heavens, and whatever you see up there, that Yeshua is up there. Now, continuing. 3:6, Paul says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for right standing. Well, here's verse 6. This is what he was saying. Abraham believed what God said about the plan of redemption, including that the one who would save his people from their sins will be in his lineage, and reckoned him with right standing. The exact same thing that we do is what Abraham did. So let's go back to Psalms 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. We're going to take a look at the zodiac, also known as Maseroth, from Job 38:32. I have shown here a list of all of the animals. Not all of them are animals, but, you know, the pictures here. And I have listed all the tribes of Israel that are associated with each one and pointed out the stars. Like I said, you can have the PDF of this. And I'm going to give you a little background just so you can see where this is coming from. The basic concept is that God identified specific stars in the sky and assigned them meanings based on their names and positions. And according to a lot of ancient histories, this was started with Adam and then was passed down to Seth and Enoch. And if you read the book of Enoch, you will find this information there. Josephus, in the first century, the first century historian, even quotes that the revelation of the two coming judgments of water and fire not be lost. There are 12 primary signs along the orbital plane and they are the same in the ancient nations of the world. I have done research on this for several years and have found that all the nations at the time of Yeshua's birth understood the pieces meaning very similar things. And I'm going to point out a couple. But before I do, I want to identify directly from the scriptures where the constellations are mentioned. Of course, we've already spoken about Job 38. Maseroth, meaning the constellations, talks about the bear and her sons, which are the smaller stars. Job 9 mentions the bear again, Orion and Pleiades and the chambers of the south. He calleth them by name. We find that in Isaiah in a couple of places. I think Isaiah 40:26 is one of them, and Psalm 147:4. And these are some of the mentions here, Pleiades and Orion in Amos. He who made Pleiades and Orion and changes deep darkness into morning is in Amos. And Castor and Pollux is mentioned in Acts 28, which are known as the twins. So we see a lot of them mentioned. One of the things that was a mystery to scientists until they discovered gravity was the question in Job 38, who can bind the cluster of Pleiades or loose the bands of Orion? They never could figure it out because they didn't know gravity existed. But then when they found out that gravity existed within the star clusters, they were able to understand what this meant. I thought that was interesting. So going back to Genesis 15, follow each constellation, reciting the associated story by the name of each star. Each star also contains what is known as three decans, which comes out to 48 stories. Each of the 12 signs are also associated with the 12 tribes. So I'm going to give you two. The first is Virgo, the promised seed of the woman, and it is a picture of a woman, as you can see on the screen there, although it's not real clear. It is up there. She has a branch in her right hand and ears of corn in her left. We know that Yeshua is referred to as a branch. In Egypt, it was known as the seed. Virgo is associated with the tribe of Zebulun, where Nazareth is located. The bright stars, these are their meanings. Gloriously beautiful. Who shall have dominion? The sun who cometh. And the three decans are the desired from Haggai, the despised from Isaiah, and the coming one from Revelation. And some of the more minor stars underneath also have names, and you can see those in Job 9 and Zechariah 12. Here's a picture of it, and I tell you what, if somebody didn't point that out to me, I would never see a woman standing there. But that's just the way it is. All right. Number two, Libra, the balances. The price deficient, balanced by the price which covers. Here you can see some of the different languages, the scales, purchase and redemption, the station of propitiation, associated with Levi. I mean, who else would it be associated with? Here is what I was very impressed with. Of the three stars, based on their names, one is the price deficient, one is the price which covers, and one is the price of the conflict. And I was like, man, that couldn't just be a coincidence. The three decans, we have the cross, which is in the southern part, and the Hebrew means cut off. We have the victim slain, and then we have the crown bestowed. So this is just a brief, quick look at a couple of the constellations, how they contain the gospel story. Here's a picture of the scales. Once again, I would have no idea, but that's how it is. All right, so now let me conclude this brief little review. Let's go back to our questions. Abraham believed something that allowed God to declare him in right standing. We know that Abraham had the gospel preached to him, so it looks like when he looked at the stars and saw Yeshua, he was believing the gospel. Now, how did the Jews hear the gospel before Yeshua? Paul says that the message in the stars has been going out to the inhabited earth, and they heard it, but refused to hear it. It was there to be heard, but they refused. I believe that was verse 17, verse 18. Do the Jews need to be saved to make the first resurrection? In Romans 10:1, Paul is very clear. Brethren, my prayer to God for the Jews is that they might be saved. If they are already saved in making the first resurrection, why would he pray to God that they might be saved? That would be my question. What is the glory of Elohim? It is the plan of redemption that he has provided for mankind, that he has made available in the stars, written by his own hand, the great watchmaker at the time of creation, that no man could reach up and change, that has preached the plan of redemption all the way up to the time of Yeshua. Psalms 19:1. Now, getting back to the quote from Dr. Wright, if the mind of the flesh does not and cannot submit to God's Torah, what is the implication for the mind of the Spirit? I believe that leading Protestant Christian scholar got it right. The works of the Torah have been written on the heart of the Gentile believer. Therefore, the implication is those with the mind of the Spirit can and do submit to God's Torah. And finally, in context, going back to Romans 10:4, does it fit that because the Jews could not fulfill God's righteous standard in the flesh, did Christ abolish God's righteous standard for all believers forever? Doesn't fit the context. But what does fit the context is believing in the finished work of Yeshua is the goal of the Torah for right standing before God for all believers, Jewish and Gentile, just like Abraham. And that is the end of this short presentation.